Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, but we're sitting at Roberta's in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and today my guest is a man who, I don't use this word lightly, and I don't think I've ever used this word on the program, but he's a true iconoclast. Now, what does that mean? Iconoclast is not icon. Iconoclast is someone who breaks the mold, has their own way to go. But I'd even go one step further. Jim Lay, the bread baker extraordinaire, never had a mold. He is truly one of the most original people with original thoughts that I have come across in my life.
Like a blob of dough I ooze.
But you rise to the occasion every time. It's what you do with the yeast. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Dorothy. Thank you for having me.
It's really great. Let me give a little background for people who might not know you, because, you know, this show is heard in over 200 countries, and we've got over a million listeners. So, first of all, if you don't know Jim, he became renowned when he opened the Sullivan Street Bakery in 1994. And he was making breads, and especially Italian breads, that everyone was coming from all over the tri-state area to buy. And he was defining the taste. I don't think we were really tasting bread like that. We had Italian bakeries, but not the authenticity with which you did it. And then he really wowed everybody because he came up with this no-knead recipe that went into the New York Times. I think hundreds, if not thousands, of bloggers, food writers. It's gone all around the world how he's managed to make an exquisite loaf of bread without kneading, and we'll go into that later. But after a Sullivan Street Bakery, he opened a pizza restaurant, because bread and pizza go together, in Chelsea, which he has now, and a small bakery next door. Run and get your bread there. And two books. I have done this recipe. It is foolproof and fail-proof, the no-knead recipe. If you want it, there's a book, My Bread. And we're very lucky, because he's now done my pizza, and I can't wait for that. The easy, no-knead way to make spectacular pizza at home. All right, so that's who I've got sitting here, and I can't wait to get into it. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dorothy. How are you?
I am good. I'm so excited to have you here.
I don't know if I have anything else to say after an intro like that.
Well, I think wait till I get to my questions, honey.
If I'm going to be iconoclastic, I should probably say nothing.
You see? I told you he was original. You do that, I'll kill you, Jim. Okay. So you're from Long Island. You're a local boy.
I am a Long Island guy.
Okay. So where did you go to school? What town?
I actually was born in Rockville Center. My parents moved to a small, I guess, mixed kind of suburb, a suburb called Williston Park, mostly working class folk, Irish, Italian. There's also next to it, we eventually moved to a town called Mineola, right next door, which actually had a very large Portuguese population. So maybe
did those food influences influence you?
I think indirectly, yeah. I mean, my Italian neighbors, the Gintas, which is an abbreviation for some other name, you know, used to cook rabbit and lasagna.
And they gave you some?
I probably may have tasted something when I was a little kid. I don't remember. But, you know, they had grapes and they made their own wine. And that was kind of exciting for me, indirectly, of course. You know, mm-hmm. 'Cause a lot of times you know,
what were you eating at home?
You know, there was the Sunday evening McDonald's run. I think that
that was.
I mean, I you know, meatballs and spaghetti, lasagna. Occasionally, I was force fed. I just refused it. But like, quote unquote, Spanish rice, Riceroni Spanish rice. You know, but I'd say not terribly creative or exciting.
Your typical American fare.
very typical. And then I think, but I did like cooking hamburgers. I mean,
that did you like to cook since you were a kid?
Obsessed with making meatballs and hamburgers. So yeah, there's definitely some weird issues going on.
It's the patty cake. Hand movement there into
the
bread.
Maybe.
Yeah. Although, what kind of student were you?
I was, as a student, a horrid student.
Were you naughty in school?
I was very disruptive and confrontational. And as far as the feedback I got punished a lot. I spent a lot of time in detention.
What school did you go to?
I went to a school called Center Street, where I had my first social meltdown, and then I went to a larger school called Jackson Avenue, where I definitely was like the outsider from the moment that I entered the school, and then eventually went to a Catholic high school for a short spell.
That's where detention comes in. Whenever anyone says detention, I think Catholic school.
No, I was in both.
They had detention in both.
Yeah, I was in both. Right. I'll try to think of that. Then I ended up going to my local Mineola High School. Mm-hmm. I bounced around to like four or five different schools. Mm-hmm. It was interesting.
All right, so when you were 15, what were you dreaming of being?
Probably a rock star, you know. I mean, I think like all kids at that point mm-hmm. want, you know.
So, who was your favorite band back then?
Ridiculous progressive rock. Everything from Peter Gabriel to Yes to Genesis to all that.
Okay, all right, we're getting the picture here.
You know, I was into probably younger. I was into painting. I was into painting denim jackets for people. I was really good at that. Yeah.
So
like Led Zeppelin album covers and.
So yeah. You went to School of Visual Arts.
Yeah.
Yeah, but was that right after high school?
I had a health crisis when I was 16 or 17 years old. I started biting my tongue uncontrollably to the point where my mouth would bleed.
Is that a thing people do, or did you? Were you the only one in the world doing that?
When they're stoned and hungry, yeah. No, just kidding. I actually had a virus attacked my hypoglossal nerve, which is the motor nerve that controls part of the tongue, my left side.
Oh.
And, you know, like a 16-year-old, I very self-conscious, I heard my voice on a tape recording of some little jam session. Mm. And I was like talking like this and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's why people treat me like I'm a fucking idiot. Now I know. It's my voice. Excuse me.
Wow.
And I think to a certain degree, I had probably had this issue for some time, mm-hmm. and my voice and my tongue, you know, began to symptomize. So I had 10 days in the hospital to think about my life. And I, you know, anytime you're 16 years old and you're laying across from like 7-year-old people in diapers that have just had a part of their brain removed, it makes you rethink. What are you going
to
do?
That adds to maturity and wisdom.
Maybe, or maybe like a reckless sense that the end is near, especially in the unevolved mind of a 16-year-old. You know.
All right. Well, take us there. So where were you?
Carpe diem.
So by 17, what were you thinking?
By 17, all I wanted to do was be an artist.
A graphic artist.
A visual painter.
Binary.
I'm an artist. I'm an artist.
What mediums?
And initially it was just painting and drawing.
Mm-hmm. And then?
But then as I began to realize, you know, in the late 80s, up until the first really big art crash around 1990, if you remember, Soho used to have 456 art galleries from Broadway westward, mm-hmm. Broadway westward. And most of those galleries had migrated there in the previous 5 years from the East Village. And at that point in time, too, there were a couple of really cool galleries in
OK Harris,
and but even in Williamsburg.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was actually an interesting thing, but it never really took root.
So that, is that? I know that you opened Sullivan Street Bakery on Sullivan Street down in Soho. Was it because of the art scene? Well, happened? Well, We didn't even get into when did you get into bread? So you're at School of Visual Arts.
I'm at schools, and
You got thrown out, didn't you?
I got thrown out for. But it was at just BS. I think I had grown tired of going there, mm-hmm. and I'd actually again in keeping with my. My academic history, I bounced back between SVA and mm-hmm. Stony Brook University, and then periods of not going to school for a six or seven year period.
So, but you wound up in Italy.
A language requirement actually brought me to Italy, because when I was in Stony Brook, I had to speak a foreign language. Mm-hmm. And I had become very intimately friendly with someone who was Italian while I was in art school. And so I'm like, hey, most of the...
So you went to Stony Brook before
went
after
to, went
art
to SVA.
School.
Yeah. Then I went to Stony Brook University.
And what were you going to study there? Or did you study there?
My art teacher was like, you're a really talented guy. I think you need to go to a college. And he said, get laid and and study broadly. Don't study now. You're not the kind of person who needs to stay on one subject. This mm-hmm. art school is too small for you, son. Mm-hmm. Move on. Mm. And so I went there, and I ended up gravitating back toward some type of graphic, except mm-hmm. at this point the artwork had become more like installation than like paintings and drawings. Mm-hmm. But that was after about 3 years of struggling to be an academic.
Doing art history.
No, I didn't do art history, although I was a student of Rosalind Krauss, which I have to say, I took an intro art class and a European art class with mm-hmm. her when she mm-hmm. was a teacher at SVA. So that's pretty cool.
That's cool, yeah. So you got to Italy to study Italian.
I went to Italy to study Italian and art history.
Rome?
Yes, there was a program that took... about 30 women, mostly Italian-American girls, and then maybe like 3 or 4 guys on a shopping excursion through all of the Italian cities for like, at that point you were using lira instead of dollars. So
you're a millionaire.
We're like gazillionaires. Americani, everybody, American over here. Oh, you come to my house tonight. My mama make me a nice dinner. It was what you expect when you go to Italy, uh-huh. And also, what I saw... Really, as an American who grew up in an Italian-American kind of neighborhood, and also, I have family in Brooklyn, and, you get the story. The expectations that I had of what Italians were like and what they really were like in 1986, say on my first trip, mm-hmm. was a complete mindfuck. And it was a good mindfuck because, I saw the remnants of ancient civil society. It's this very rehearsed and very practiced way of social decorum, if you will, politeness, manners, dress, sense of self-respect, moment for rest, a small walk, a smoke, a glass of wine.
A civilized life.
It's civil society. I mean, there's still mm-hmm. kind of wacko, and there's still mental illness, and there's still mm-hmm. all the same issues that our culture suffers or experiences. I don't want to say suffers from because, but experiences. But it was a complete revelation.
So got your bread epiphany?
Well, inside that civil society, you have the practice of making food. And, for me, the bonding moment between mother and child, my mom and would let me help make food, and sometimes I would prepare food, and then also seeing, going to a cafeteria and eating food that was better than anything I'd ever eaten in the United States, ever, 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 and actually I would even say better than most of the food in most of the restaurants in New York City in 19... No, just talking. But I would say on par with some of the best eats I've ever eaten. Not special, not fancy, but just really well made by these three women in their 60s.
In a cafeteria?
In a cafeteria. Well, for obviously owned and run by the Vatican.
Oh, it was a cafeteria in the Vatican.
No, it's like the Vatican owns all these buildings that are like pensione for like student groups that come in. And vis-a-vis Fordham University, which we were kind of partnered with, Stony Brook University, that is, mm-hmm. we were brought there, I guess, I don't know.
Student digs.
But you know, the food was pretty.
Okay. Well, yeah. we're gonna take a
for
stop
cafeteria
here.
Food, that was, yeah.
We're gonna take a break. When we come back, we're gonna hear about your food experiences in Italy.
Okay.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate. An incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Hi, welcome back to Chef Story. Jim and I are just having great time in here. Anyway, we left you off in Rome, and I think I know you had a lot of experiences there. Let's stick to the food, honey.
Yeah,
and I want
to
know about the bread.
Something. Perhaps the food that I ate at that very impressionable age wasn't that good, as I was saying. But for my young...
So this is revisionist history, right?
Maybe it was. I can't remember. I'm so far away from it.
Right.
But definitely the culture of the food, the values in the culture mm-hmm. affected me because... You know, I would go to a market and someone would hand me a tomato to taste, a whole tomato, not a slice of a tomato, but a tomato, mm-hmm. and say, probably because I was an American, I had dollars or had mucho lira. They were like, you know, signore, assaggi, taste this. And I ate a tomato and it was like eating a peach for me. It was like eating something delicious. And of course, I eat peaches like I never ate before, or grapes, or, you know, saw new ways to see and taste pizza other than what my experience up until that age mm-hmm. had allowed me to do. Now, of course, fast forward 30 years or 25 years, where everyone's educated, everyone's knowledgeable, everyone's a food expert, everyone's traveled everywhere. You know, it's kind of an interesting shift of paradigm.
Is it more challenging to work in this environment because to make different or more delicious food, you've got a lot more competition levels of excellence out there to exceed?
Yeah, I think that just like reality TV shows on food, where the bar is being continuously raised, I think culturally our society is going through its own struggle for whatever identity, regional or national. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the national cuisine debate, i.e. hamburgers and slices of pizza.
No, wait, let's get to bread. Are there regional breads here in the United States?
Is there regional agriculture for wheat? And are the distinctive differences between, say, for example, a monocrop or a or a regional wheat grown here versus a commodity grain or a grain that's traded for its like use value or its properties, that's really the debate of whether there's a regional bread or not. I mean, when we kind of refer back to European baking traditions and we look at Europe, in as much as table manners and the ritual of dining is something that is wholly European.
Asians have table manners.
Well, no, I'm not talking about that, but I'm saying that the concept of sitting at a table, having plates, having silverware, having forks, having knives. I read a little book recently called The Meal, and it looks back at art from antiquity, pan-cultural, as the evolution of how we came to have the table and the plate. During the Renaissance, people would share one plate, one cup, a set of utensils, but later on, it evolved,
I think the Italians had something to do with
the
that
Italians
too.
Had according to this historian, it started in Tuscany,
mm-hmm.
which is a kind of cool thing.
Cesare Casella would thank you for
that. He probably would, but I could believe it, and it also came out of the ritualization of the meal in monasteries, mm-hmm. where you had a meal in the morning or no meal, or you had a meal at lunch, mm-hmm. and everyone had to help prepare and cook.
Mm-hmm. All right, wait. Anyway,
we're going way off because
everybody wants to know how you got your inspiration. Okay. How did you start learning about bread? Because the way you think about it, I think, is differently than, I want to get in that brain.
Well, I think of it as a living blob. So whether it's a little blob or a big blob or a giant blob, it's a kind of a living colony that has its influences and factors,
So when did you first encounter the blob?
When I was young, after I got back from Italy and I had this really incredible cafeteria food, I began to analyze. I went back to Stony Brook, by the way. Mm-hmm. I began to become proselytize. I bought myself a little mocha so I could start making myself a cup of espresso, all in the morning, maybe three or four mochas, and then maybe in the afternoon after my siesta, because I also like that too. I thought that was very civilized. I couldn't always take a siesta, but I tried. But when I came back, I began to question and look at the food that I was being served at by this large company that the university had contracted out to provide food service.
Yeah.
In quotation marks. And I became like really angry. And so what do you do when you're angry?
You do something.
You buy a book.
You buy a book.
You buy a book and you read it. So I bought a cookbook.
Which book?
I actually bought, not knowing what book to buy, went to Barnes & Noble when Barnes & Noble was a mega store on Fifth Avenue. I bought Anne Willen's book.
Oh.
La Varenne, La Pratique.
It's a good book, and
she's a fabulous woman. It's a phenomenal book. Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry.
Anne wouldn't like that.
Yeah. No, it was a very, very good book. Sorry, Anne. Anne, if you're listening. This is a very casual setting. We're in Roberta's. It was a really, really good book for a very young mind to reference also what I had just experienced.
Because it was a basic skills book.
Basic skills, like how to make a stock.
So you were learning all about food, not just bread.
At that point, I did not want to eat the food that my cafeteria was serving us.
Yes.
That, and I went, it was just like, I couldn't. It mm-hmm. was, I was getting very, I was on the vegetarian meal program, and it was abysmal.
It probably still is.
Tater tots.
Yeah.
Tater tots.
Oh, gosh.
Tater
All
tots.
Right.
And, yeah.
Okay, so now getting... Did you learn your bread technique from La Pratique?
Well, I started... I ended up wanting to bake some bread one day.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also had established an addiction to this substance called Nutella.
Oh, right. That's another European.
Yeah. Well, '80s Nutella, you know, Nutella in Italy in the 80s is sort of like
Hershey's,
you know, Plaid in Williamsburg in the early 2000s or something. Yeah. You know, it's just, it was very, very hip. It was very, and everyone ate Nutella. All the kids did, but you had to have it on that crusty bread.
Yeah.
And those, you know, in Rome, and that's where I was. So it was like these very large, round loaves with a very dark crust and a really open, kind of very waxy looking crumb. And so the only book, I mean, I had that book, so I plowed through that chapter and did everything and every recipe that was there. I think including croissants, and, you know, with a pretty good degree of success.
And you were happy with yours.
I was very, very happy. And then immediately bought...
What kind of yeast did you use in those days? Did you get Fleischmann's?
At that point, I was buying fresh yeast, like a knucklehead, because I didn't realize that fresh yeast was a kind of like an oxymoron. Doesn't really exist.
Oh, okay, because I'm a knucklehead now. I didn't realize that.
Well, I mean, it's fresh for like 2 days if you live near, or a week if you live near the... its place of manufacture, but it's very unstable. Its gassing power dives pretty fast. So, you know, if you want to use fresh yeast, you have to kind of have
what is fresh yeast? Is it
it's just like a cream that's skimmed off the top and dehydrated and made into these blocks, like malt and...
So do you have to actually make your own yeast to have it to be fresh?
No, because the lab yeast that we buy as fresh yeast or dried yeast is a
preserved yeast.
No, it's like a clone, but not quite a clone. It's not really capable of sustaining itself. It just kind of gets ill and dies.
Does fresh yeast make a bread better?
I think, you know, again, when it comes to using yeast, obviously the fresher and more viable the inoculant is, the better or more predictable your result. But obviously if you have a little block of yeast and it's been sitting in your refrigerator half open for like a month or something, you know, it's, you know, probably going to make your bread taste a little funk, you know. I mean, I don't do this, so I don't know. I can honestly say that.
All right, I'm getting off.
My practice, point here. My practice is different.
I, you know, whenever I notice my knucklehead tendency,
no,
I
but have it's not, it's educated. Not, it's not knucklehead because it's also, again, it's like growing up eating McDonald's. It's only what you know.
Exactly.
So that could actually be the new slogan for McDonald's. It's only what you know.
All right. So you learned.
It's only what you don't know.
All right. McDonald's getting too many plugs here.
I know. I'm sorry. Sorry.
So when you started making your own bread and it was better than anything you tasted in the United States, did you have a mentor of any sort? Did you go anywhere to learn more about bread baking?
No, I didn't.
You just did it yourself.
I just started doing it, and I kept, you know, like, remember that movie Spielberg movie Close Encounters?
Yes.
And there's, like, the Richard Dreyfuss character, and he's making this sculpture, mm-hmm. like, in his head. I became obsessed. I kept trying to make this certain style of bread that somehow I felt some sort of thing with. But, you know, I also began to experiment and just try different things out as well, so...
Were you scientific about it?
Somewhat. Weighing things to a fault and then switching immediately over to the metric system. I've been metric for...
Isn't that rare for an artist to be so precise like that?
Not if you want a predictable second thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is cooking... You know, when you're just cooking for someone, I'm not going to weigh out the salt that I put on the steak for Dorothy when you come over. But
I always think artists, and especially fine art, are very instinctual and kind of go with the flow. And pastry people and bread people are very precise. And it seems like you have both sides of the brain there.
Well, the problem is I can't sell you the beautiful, the work of a lot of kind of decisions and effort. And knowledge or practice, I can't sell you that thing if I don't
know how to replicate it.
Yeah, rein it in.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like, well, you know, maybe today I'll, you know, bird will come out at like 2, and you know, the customer, I mean, because I'm also as a business guy, the customer doesn't like that.
So it was trial and error, trial and error. Did you buy a lot of books?
I bought actually Carol Field's book, The Italian Baker. Right. Love that book. What
She's
a brilliant
book.
She's
from San Francisco, right? Yeah. So was there a lot of sourdough in there?
No, but...
Or Italian?
She, you know, she's a beautiful writer, and I think she really had a keen eye for her observations about the things she saw, because I ended up, when I went back to Italy in later years to do, like, quote-unquote research, I used her book, and I went to Terni, and I went to... Genzano, and I tried to kind of follow a lot of her. I mean, I didn't make it to any specific bakeries in or towns in Sicily, but I think it was her observation that influenced me. So when I began to see what she saw, you know, like you know, your life is an experience is like putting a puzzle together, and sometimes we're really, really fortunate to see things that kind of link together and form a sentence or form an idea. In this case, without realizing it, I became obsessed with this process, and I got to see it in several different countries. I also had a stint, I think shortly after my tongue issue when I was 16, of working as a bagel baker. I baked bagels. That was my first baking job.
Were they good?
They were pretty nice. They were pretty tasty, yeah. They were very good. Actually, the bagel bakery is still there.
Is it the old water bagel, or is it,
was
it the
a water,
chewy?
It was a water bagel.
Mammoth chewy thing.
Yeah, it was a water bagel on a you know, we boiled all the bagels in a cauldron. We set the bagels up on these slats. 2x4s that were lined with a belt, basically like a belt, fabric belt. Totally, like, would not pass Department of Agriculture or Department
today.
Of... Yeah, I mean, my first task, just to give you an idea of, like, how gnarly it was. I can tell you a story. Well, my first task when I would come into the bakery was to clean out all the cockroaches.
Let's not go there.
From the bagel machines. But it was really, you know, it was eye-opening. I saw more things in the bakery.
Did you feel like you were working with bread, or was that a whole different? Was that a manufacturing process?
It was a really kind of cool thing to do. It was really novel. It was also a very, very popular place. It was also a different food culture
back
then,
too. Do you do bagels
now? No. I'm going to, just for fun, I'm going to try to make, for fun... not for commercial reasons, for art's sake, the perfect bagel in the next couple weeks.
Visually or taste-wise?
The whole thing.
Okay, so you have to have a taste panel. Can I be on it?
Yes, of course.
And you know who else
how
we have to
I'll,
get?
How about
Mimi
I'll send
Sheridan.
You? How about
she...
I'll send you?
Okay, but we get Mimi Sheridan because she's written a lot. Now, let's get back. Well, yeah. We're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to delve more into your bread baking. So here we go. Welcome back. Whoa, that was Andrew White. my friend from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Go online and get all his music there. Well, you're listening to Chef Story, and Dorothy Cann Hamilton here, and I am talking to Jim Lay of Sullivan Street Bakery and Co., and two great books coming out. Well, one book out, My Bread, The Revolutionary No Work, No Need Method, that came out in 2009. And this year, or maybe last year, we just had our last book. My Pizza, The Easy No Need Way to Make a Spectacular Pizza at Home.
Yeah, they're both really great books.
They are.
And they're happy and fun, and you can learn how to make amazing, either very basic, very simple breads using the No Need Method in My Bread.
How did you come up with that? Let's get to the big question.
In the walk through life, experiencing different things and reading different things, I began to sort of put this puzzle together about in fantasizing about how bread may have been made 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, that it really just became about, you know, in a pre-industrial world, about materials handling. And it just so happened that this mixture of flour and water symbolized this. It's had a lot of symbolism to it. It's completely lost from our culture now because we don't think of it anymore. It's just we think of it differently now. Now we're thinking about the grains it's made out of, how it's fermented, the type of cooking technique applied. But back then, it was a sustaining food. It was also part of, you know, it's forever been in this culture of subsidy from the time of the ancient Romans till, you know, even to this day in Italy, in the culture of the Italian, they don't think that bread should cost more than a certain amount per euro. You know, they're not going to pay more than a euro per kilo of bread. It's an insult. And to a certain degree, that's kind of killing the baking industry there to some degree, because there's no, unless you're a factory, there's no way to make money. Mm-hmm. Pretty much the landscape of our kind of baking culture here, it's pretty hard for the small bakery to, let's say, have traction for many different reasons. One could be its consistency. Another could be its price point in order for it to make money. Like if you have a wood-fired oven like they do here at Roberta's, or you're a small-scale craft bakery, let's say, you have
a lot of different... you know, because people think it's just flour, salt, yeast. How expensive can it be?
Yeah, it's the labor.
It's
the labor.
So tell me, in your bakery, how much goes into making a loaf of bread?
How much is in money?
No, like how many people?
Oh my! Well, look at it this way: you make a 200-pound batch of flour. You have to take 200 pounds and put it into a mixer. Then you have to add 180 pounds of water to the 200 pounds of flour. Now you've got 380 pounds of
stuff. Blob.
You have the large blob. You inoculate it with some stuff, right?
That's the yeast. The yeast. Which is not fresh.
Or the sourdough. I'd say the starter, the biga, the sourdough mother, I think, is the way to go. Mm-hmm. And then you inoculate it, and then you've got to remove it from the bowl. Mm-hmm. Give it some degree of structure or not.
What do you mean, structure?
Well, going back to kneading versus not kneading, you either like bring all the ingredients together, mm-hmm. and then as quickly, as briefly as possible, then remove the dough from the bowl, let it rest or remove it or just remove it. Or you mix the dough to some extent, and you might introduce the salt later, or you might mix it.
When you say to some extent, do you know that by your hand, your eye, or your hand feel?
I typically use my eyes only because I don't want to get my hands too dirty. I also don't feel always this compulsive need to touch the dough like I used to when I started my practice. But when you start a practice, you want to touch everything. So I used to tell by the viscosity of the dough. mm-hmm. whether it's correct. And I might touch it to feel the temperature of the dough.
Oh.
Especially if, for
it
example...
It gets warmer as it sits there because of the yeast?
Well, the larger the blob, the more its insular mass, the more heat, the faster it will ferment. The smaller the blob, the less insular mass, and the more subject it is to temperature fluctuations. So, for example, if it's very, very cold outside, just like our fingers and toes are cold in the studio, and we're a tiny little blob of dough, we're not going to really have... We're going to ferment very slowly, whereas if we're 380 pounds of blob, we'll actually be quite happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might be a little less fermented on the on our exterior.
So is that important? Because in your no-knead recipe, you kind of leave it for 12 hours. You can go to sleep and you can leave it.
You don't, on weather like we're having right now, if you were to mix a batch of dough and leave it for 3 days,
mm-hmm.
untouched, though, you can't shake it, you can't move it, you can't check it. Don't touch it. You can lift the lid if you want to look, but don't touch it. You probably could leave it for up to 3 days.
Does it have more flavor if you leave it for 3 days?
It gets different. It gets a funk to it. I think you might end up with some secondary fermentation. But the temperature of the dough will probably remain so cold because of how cold it is outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about putting the bowl that you've mm-hmm. made in your oven on a rack
mm-hmm.
with the oven light on. I'm talking about leaving it out on
just
a
naturally.
Shelf near the window or whatever. Yeah, just, you know. Don't think about it. And I think that perhaps, you know, in order for bread to have flourished and survived, it must have been really easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it certainly wasn't easy to... It took 17 people to sow and cultivate and harvest an acre of grain.
Right.
17 people, you know. That's a lot for every acre.
And how many loaves of bread can
you... And then when the Industrial Revolution happened, it was... One person every 500 acres.
Wow.
So that was had a huge effect on our society and our culture. And I would think that, you know, baking probably looks similar to agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's get back. Was it a fluke that you discovered no-knead bread, or did you think, let me try this? And was it an intellectual?
It was both. I mean, it was observation. It was something I had also learned when I had traveled to Florida to try to look into the possibility of opening a bakery there in the early 90s. I was still living in Williamsburg. And my business, my boss, this guy named Joe Allen of Restaurant Row.
Oh, right.
Sent me down to Florida to see whether I could bake bread down in South Beach because he wanted to open up a bakery. He was very visionary, extremely visionary. I wish he took my advice on Williamsburg, but...
So wait, we're talking about how you came up with
I went down to Florida. I had already experienced baking. I was already practicing baking. I was already baking. I had already developed a little bit of a reputation as a very good baker. I would try making dough, and I would notice that within seconds of incorporating the flour and water together, the dough was perfect. Within seconds of incorporating everything, the dough was perfect. Like, perfect. That if I kept kneading the dough, it would begin to disintegrate and fall apart.
Oh.
And I just thought, I'm in a tropical environment for whatever reason. My first thought, of course, is it's the water, right? Mm-hmm. I eventually later tested the water out and found out why. Years later, but I did test the water. And it's a chemical, specific chemical reaction to magnesium phosphates or magnesium...
That was in that water.
In water that can actually cause proteins to denature and align very quickly. And if you keep kneading the dough, it basically falls apart, which is why everyone always says you can't make good bread in Florida. But it's actually the opposite. You can make better bread in Florida.
If you don't need it.
You can make better bread in Florida, I think, than probably anywhere in the U.S. with. And better in the
in the challenge to Miami down there.
Challenge to all Floridians. You can make better bread in Florida because you don't have to use electricity or even physical energy. It's hot down there, right?
Right.
Who wants to sweat?
Right.
And you can do the same thing up here as well, using the no-knead method. But you have to think that if baking was to...
So did it start down there? Is that where you did your first no-knead
bread? I did my first no-kneads in South Beach in 1992.
You were in 91, Williamsburg. 92. You were in Williamsburg in the 80s. You were down in South Beach in the 90s.
No, I was living. On Metropolitan Avenue when I went to South Beach.
Wow, those were the days.
Those are the days.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So, were you surprised?
No. Yes and no. I mean, I thought it was a really unusual thing. I began to practice it and had some great successes. I taught a guy down there how to do it. For change.
And then when you had Sullivan Street Bakery, did you make your no-knead bread and sell it? Or
no, when I opened Sullivan Street, I didn't all of a sudden decide right then and there I'm going to practice no-knead. No. I was still a kind of firm convert that dough had to be, like, you know, really wet. And
you were very Italian in your breads.
Yeah. I mean, again, that was the my archetype. When I went back to Italy, and also I think that there is that culture of bread that dates back to antiquity, that dates back to ancient Greece, because presumably the Greeks were the kind of artists of all the known, according to one bread historian. The Greeks were the artists and created most of the bread forms that we know and love today. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would never know that when you go.
What's your favorite bread right now to eat? And what's your favorite bread to make?
I like making, I guess my two favorite breads would be just the classic, my classic pizza bianca. Mm-hmm. And then my other favorite bread, if I were to like pick a bread that I would eat every day, would be this naturally leavened bread we make called truccio. Truccio.
What does that look like?
It looks like an oblong, semi-burnt, almost burnt loaf.
Is the burn important?
I think that bringing the crust of the dough just shy of being burnt, mm-hmm. so you're not bitter yet, but you're almost bitter. If it's combined with the right,
How do you do that? How do you get it just to the point where it's...
Highest possible temperature, shortest possible time. You know, a loaf of bread bakes when you lose 20... A loaf of bread will form crust when you lose 20% of its weight. This is like an average. And regardless of the quantity of water that's put in, mm-hmm. crust will form, I mean, to a degree. Crust will form when you lose 20% of your water weight. So if I have a 1,000 grams of dough going into the oven, I could safely pull it out when it's at 800 grams, mm-hmm. and know that if I let it cool slowly, a beautiful crust will form on the outside. If I pull it out when it's 900 grams, it's going to be kind of all bumpy and mushy and wet. If I pull it out when it's 750 grams, let's say, it's going to be one of those like crusts that, you know, that
you don't have a scale in the oven to know when it reaches that point.
No, but there are certain predictable times and timings. There are certain things that you look at as a baker to see.
What's your favorite oven to work with? Is it wood burning is it?
I don't have a favorite oven. Any oven that I'm working on at the moment has to be my favorite oven.
So you were just in Turkmenistan.
Yeah, I was just
making turkeys for the American ambassador for Thanksgiving. What kind of oven did you have
I had Soviet era electric deck ovens. Everything there is electric. The entire kitchen I was working in, a large catering kitchen, was electric.
How'd your bread turn out?
Bread turned out great. I mean, it was we did no-knead whole wheat bread. I brought whole wheat flour from the U.S. of A. because whole wheat in Turkmenistan is extremely scarce, of extremely questionable quality and extremely expensive. Actually, you just can't find whole wheat flour there, period. Or I couldn't.
All right. Well, we're you know what? We're actually out of time.
Oh.
But I'm going to ask you to come back because it's so much fun to talk to you.
Well, thank
and
you,
we've
Dorothy.
Hardly I didn't scratched plug, the crumb, the surface.
And I didn't even plug my
Well, let's plug. Books. Let's plug right away. My pizza. Tell them about my pizza.
Oh, my pizza is a really fun kind of Valentine to my beautiful restaurant company, which is on the corner of 24th and 9th Avenue in Chelsea. And it's just like a compendium of really innovative pizza recipes that utilize a lot of vegetables. So we have a lot of vegan, vegetarian recipes in the book, and kind of tries to find this balance between, you know, the art of ingredient and the art of a finished pie and salad.
You really have set the bench in New York for pizza.
Well, now the artisan, thank you.
It's not me, it's the New York Times. It says that as well.
Well, I was really happy to see that the New York Times even gave a 2-star to another pizza restaurant. That's exciting. Mm. I have to get re-reviewed now.
Mm-hmm. Hear that?
Hear that?
New York Times?
Hear that,
okay.
Well?
Okay, so we've got, if you're not, or if you are in New York and you haven't been to Co., you have to go. If you're coming to New York, you have to go.
Yeah,
and
we have a beautiful little craft bakery, 2 doors away from Co., a little Sullivan Street bakery.
Where you do the torchon,
we do some fresh batches of bread there several times a day. And then, of course, my bread, my pizza. And I am working right now on a new book.
Oh, what's that?
A Sullivan Street Bakery book, which is going to be a little bit more on a technical side.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Yeah.
All right.
In metrics, the whole book.
Well, I hope we're going to see you at school teaching. So.
Yeah, I would
that
be honored.
Too.
Be honored. Be honored.
Okay, well, Jim.
Dorothy, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.